Check, check, check. Testing, testing.
Testing, testing. Looks like we can both talk.
Yeah. So, okay, it's 15 past, so it's time to start. So let's continue or start with the things. So this is a session about real-life transformations from the FTC to CAM. The FTC means full trust code, essentially meaning farm solutions. The way we've been doing customizations within the SharePoint in 2007 and 2010. And also in 2013. And the CAM means, well, it's a cloud application model. To be honest, nowadays we prefer usage of app model, not cloud application model, because we don't want to say that it's only for cloud. We want to make the app model to be present in on-premises as well. I'm Vesa Juvonen. Let's do introductions on our own slides. So my name is Vesa Juvonen. I'm a principal consultant for Microsoft Consulting Services. And this is kind of an interesting session for me. I used to be a MCM instructor for 18 rotations since the 2008 until we, well, killed the training. And I've been teaching all the time how to do full trust code, except now on the final rotation. So now I'm turned around on the other side, and I'm saying, yeah, don't do full trust code. Do the new stuff. Do the stuff which works both in on-prem and in the cloud. So it's been kind of an interesting time for me also to learn the new way of doing stuff and what we want to do in the future within the SharePoint. I'm also a SharePoint Ranger. It's a smaller group, virtual group of people, and I'm the only EMEA Ranger. So essentially when there's a big light, a big customer yelling, or a big customer which needs pre-sales help, I'm the one who goes there to convince from a technical perspective that customer. And with me on the stage is Steve Walker.
Steve Walker, I am a senior program manager on the Office 365 customer advisory team. Prior to that, I was on the SharePoint customer advisory team. And prior to that, I was a SharePoint Ranger and an MCS consultant. I twisted and bent SharePoint in ways that you maybe should or shouldn't have. So I got a lot of experience on what works and what doesn't, and pretty deep knowledge on how to do full trust code development, farm solutions. And I've been working with Vesa and our field community team on how do we get folks to start using the new app model as opposed to the traditional models. So this is the beginning of a journey. You know, I know a lot of folks are very interested in seeing guidance and seeing patterns and practices. So we're excited to start sharing this stuff with you now.
Good. Moving on, I'll let Steve actually... I'll let Steve do the intros on our new application model. You've probably seen this quite a few times already, this line.
Yep, so this is kind of our standard slide. We know our development model in the past has really been very centric around SharePoint. I mean, we did have Office extensions as well, but the way we're looking at Office 365 now is really as a platform. One that you can use flexible tooling, use the devices that your users are using, and still build the same apps and have them render and be operable. So.
Good. Yeah. Let's move on the real topic of today. So you've seen that slide quite a few times. So today in this session, we're going to concentrate how did we actually transform one existing full trust customer, actually in Office 365 dedicated, but essentially same as on-premises full trust or farm solution development, to this new SharePoint app world. And this is a one customer case which we've been working, I started working with the customer actually already in 2010, and we kind of drive this content out of this customer case. We're gonna reference other customers as well. Steve is with me on the stage to ask those questions which will come up during the slides. So he'll be like your representative on the stage when we go through the slides, so you don't have to start asking questions during the session. You're obviously more than welcome to ask any questions after we went through the material. We just want to make sure that we actually go through the material.
Yeah, and I do want to make one observation. You said Office 365 dedicated. Right now, that's pretty much like running on-prem, right?
That's correct. So Office 365 dedicated is not necessarily familiar for all of you, but it's essentially a SharePoint farm, like on-prem, but it's hosted from the Microsoft data center. And that's an offering which is it's really limited for high-end big customers.
Yep.
What we want to do in the future is more concentrate on the Office 365 multi-tenant side.
And we in the engineering team have goals that we will converge those platforms in the future. So while today, if you have customers that are in our dedicated platform, they can still rest assured that their full trust code will be accepted there. There will be a time in the future when we will be motivated to not allow that anymore. So just throwing that out there.
So anyway, let's have a look on the customer. Let's have a look on what the customer had in 2010. And how did we make the transformation? So what were the techniques? We're going to actually go to the real production. So we're going to see how the systems look after the appification. By the way, not an official term, just completely out of my top of my head. But how do things actually look after we've cut rid of the full trust code and how things work and how we're able to still inject whatever customizations, branding, additional stuff on the what is needed for the end user perspective. And this is going to be a 300 level session in the sense that we do assume that you have a technical knowledge on SharePoint. So we're not going to go precisely to a code. We're going to cover a lot of technical stuff. So we're going to assume that you understand SharePoint, but we're more going to concentrate on a functional perspective and how the transformation was actually done. So this is not about 30 minutes of code session. This is about how actually functionalities can be transformed.
Right. But there is a session tomorrow where we're diving a little deeper into the code, right, Vesa?
Yeah, so tomorrow morning we do a session related on site provisioning where we're going to explain then a lot of these concepts from here as well. And we have published a lot of this material and code actually in the officeams.codeplex.com. Which is free to use code examples for you from all of these big customers, what we work with. Yeah. Anyway, moving on the content. So the UPM, this is a case from the UPM. UPM is old paper manufacturer company, and now they're transforming to be a so-called Biofore company. It's a Finnish-driven global company. They have location or factories in 15 countries within the world. 22,000 accounts, so not massively big, but pretty big as well. And they are listed in the Nasdaq OMX Helsinki. WWUBM.com is, by the way, hosted within the SharePoint platform as well. So decent-sized company, which has decent size of customizations as well. But before we go to the technology, the one thing what I wanted to also kind of a pinpoint is the key question what our customers actually have. Why would you do this? So what was actually the customer's business case of doing that? We will support full trust code now, and we will support the full trust code in the future as well. But what was the customer thinking related on the project? So why did they decide to do so? And in the customer's perspective, last spring we did this kind of a business analysis and architectural assessment for them. And the end result was that they have four different kind of key pillars which we want to tackle. The number one pillar is cloud ready. It's not hosted in cloud. It's not go to the cloud. It's being cloud ready, regardless where the customizations and deployment are actually hosted. Because the cloud ready meant for the IT director the opportunity that he can actually choose which platform he wants to host that SharePoint deployment. Is it Office 365? Is it on-prem? Is it some third-party provider? Is it some random fourth-party provider, whatever that means? He can choose, and he can decide that in any given time. If he is not happy with Office 365, he can take that away and move it to another environment. So the customizations or the deployment shouldn't be deciding where the deployment is actually running. That was a major deal for the IT director or the CIO of the company. The second thing was the HR for business. So obviously the IT is always there, the technology is always there to support business. How we can make functionalities or how we can enable business and end users to do certain things. The business itself, business organizations started complaining. The full trust code lifecycle model was so difficult that it takes 6 weeks to get anything updated within the production because you need to do first dev, then daily build, then weekly build, then AM. Then the weekly, monthly testing, then the QA, the pre-production, to send it for final approval and sign-off.
And is that just for their app?
Well, that's not just UPM. So and to be honest, as part of those persons who've been really strongly helping guidance on ALM, I'm one of the persons to blame. I've been really strongly recommending certain ALM practices. But at the same time, if we start doing too academically correct ALM practices, it might actually destroy the agility. So the business is not happy because they want to have a small modification in a master page or a widget on the intranet, and it takes 6 weeks to get it there.
And that's an average time or a normal time if you're deploying anything into our dedicated service. So our dedicated customers have gotten used to that. You know, it's going to take 6 weeks to do this. We see a lot of customers on-prem running their own farms that have that level of rigor as well, typically the ones who have brought their intranets down with a full trust code solution that they deployed. So it's not just safety for your app. I mean, yeah, it's a bad thing if your app actually goes down, but you know, SharePoint is a platform. You're running many, many, many different things on it. So there's a lot of risk that not just the app you deployed to goes down, but the entire farm becomes unavailable. And so that's why a lot of customers will step back and get a lot of rigor around how they deploy these customizations in the farms today.
And the third pillar, moving on the list, was the cost efficiency. So the customer wanted to have the opportunity, A, like mentioned, compete against the service providers at any given time, so they can switch between the service provider. But also the fact that they wanted to start thinking that, why do we always need to make this thing so difficult? Can't we do something in a more agile way? Can't we just deploy something there without the need of always doing and getting the IT involved? So using the alternative new models, or that was the objective, we wanted to provide the business and the end users more flexible opportunities to do so. And the final opportunity, or final kind of a pillar, is to customize for business value. That doesn't directly relate on SharePoint, but it's more about the fact that the customer felt that in the old way they were doing business or IT or customizations, people always, they didn't really evaluate how much does it cost and what's the value. So they started writing full trust code for the sake of the full trust code, rather than just thinking that, okay, what's the additional value of that investment? If Steve is going to actually work 5 days for that customization, that's going to cost them blah, blah, blah. Is it actually giving the value back?
And I pay a tax for that ongoing, right?
True, and then depending on your customization style, there's the maintenance, there's the operation impact, and so on. So there's a lot of the kind of things which we need to take into consideration. Okay, good. That's about the business side of it. So let's concentrate on the technology, because I think this is a developer session. So we need to understand what did they have and how did the transformation was done. So 2010 implementation. So let's go through this quickly. I'm going to show some pictures and summarizing what did they actually have. So the UPM intranet was built back in 2011, and it's built and it's hosted in Office 365 Dedicated. And it's highly branded, highly customized intranet. The intranet itself, which is the intranet.upm.com, is a publishing site. It's almost a publishing site which looks like a .com site because it's so highly customized from a branding perspective. There's a lot of content sharing. It's mainly for content sharing. It's highly customized, as mentioned. It has publishing features enabled, which is pretty typical for this size of a customer. And at roughly 2,000 sites in a one site collection. That's, well, not necessarily optimal, but that's side of track from a customization perspective. If we move forward what do they actually have, the collaboration and my sites, pretty highly customized from a branding perspective as well. You can see that the my site, well, it has familiar elements, but it's still highly branded. And the team site had this small, brilliant idea, actually I'm the one to blame, that the team site are running with the publishing features enabled. At the time of 2010, at the time when we did the SharePoint 2010, there were certain reasons why we went to that direction. The reality is that was a bad decision, which is now backfiring on us related on this transformation project. And I'm going to talk about that one within the later part of the deck.
So I would like, show of hands, who here does not have a requirement to have common branding across their environment? I think we're hitting a good scenario.
Good. So UBM is a pretty typical branding, big corporate-wide branding, and then customizations. The overall customization stack was much more than just branding. We're talking about 25 web templates, no custom site definitions, luckily, 65 features, 15 content types, roughly 30 web parts, 20 web controls, 20 page layouts, 12 timer jobs, central admin customizations. Well, not necessarily a good idea, but you can do those. So that's easily doable if you know what you're doing. And the final thing was the hybrid self-service site collection creation. So there was a pretty big customization, which is taking care of the hybrid site collection creation, self-service site collection creation to on-prem or to the cloud, depending on the metadata selections of the end user. So is the information confidential or not? If it's not, it's going to create that to the cloud. So that was 2010. The customer overall landscape in 2010 was pretty massive. I'm not going to go through and explain that in a highly detailed, but we're talking about developer boxes, daily builds, weekly builds, pre-testing, QA testing, pre-production, two different farms, actually multiple farms for extranets and intranets and so on. In this session, we're going to concentrate on the intranet, but still like 30 individual servers, which have maintenance costs, operational costs, and all of that. So it was a pretty massive cost perspective, and the yearly costs were pretty significant. So obviously, the customer wanted to cut down those costs by changing and optimizing some of the development practices. And the one thing that we mentioned already was the business feedback. It takes us up to 6 weeks to get something updated to our release model with the FTC. Business couldn't understand in 2020, 2012, 2013, how can it take 6 weeks to get the new widget to the intranet? It's just insane. Well, that was mainly because their ALM process was academically correct, but it wasn't business perspective the optimal one. So product itself doesn't require that, and that's a really key point. We need to always think about our solutions based on the business objectives, what we're actually designing, not necessarily a random blog post within the internet. And I do have a lot of those blog posts as well, which probably are not the best practice anymore because they were written in 2007.
But I think a good point there is that a lot of customers ended up with those types of environments because of the change that was introduced in those environments. They had to get defensive about change because that full trust code is so invasive.
True. Yep. They wanted to minimize the possible impact of the full trust code to the existing production. Anyway, so how did we approach this before we go to the real, how is it actually looking and how things are implemented? The key point on our approaching of this one is not, it's actually the one that there's no one-to-one match. So we need to understand the real business scenarios. We need to understand why the customization is there. You don't want to do a automated analytics on a there's a web part, it's an app part, there's a web part, it's an app part, it's a web control, it's nothing, it's a whatever, do a remote provisioning.
What do I do with that HTTP handler?
What do I do with the HTTP handler? Well, probably not that much.
That's right.
But what we need to do is think about what's beyond that. The technology is always there for some reason. We always do development. As a developers, we need to understand that the fact that I'm getting a task to develop something, that's because some business objective, there's a business objective behind. And with CAM or with the app model, it's all about enabling the same functionality using just alternative means. So we're not going to use the same old necessarily technology or model in the FTC. We just take an alternative means, but from an end user perspective, they can actually do the same stuff. It enables the same business scenario. So that means that we actually need to think about what do we actually have and why do we have it. And you can't really get the whole transformation started if you don't know what's the business objective. We need to understand that. It's not about technology. And it's all about also understanding then the cost versus gain. Going through once again those full trust code elements, like in UPM's case, there was one of my favorite web parts was the Polo web part, which was developed, I think it was something like 2 weeks when it was developed in 2010 timeframe. And now we started analyzing, so what kind of code do we have? And then there's the Polo web part, and we realized that that had never been used. So obviously we don't want to then enable that. We don't want to spend time on something which is not truly used, or if it's used once in a whole intranet, is it worthwhile to actually convert that to the new model? Is it worthwhile of the investment? And comparing the pain as well from a development perspective.
Sure.
From a UPM perspective, what we wanted to do, and this is actually a really good practice, we are seeing this now with the other customers as well who are making the transition, go gradually. Let's start by introducing functionalities and transformation gradually. Let's not try to do the whole big bang. Well, that's an alternative as well. Yeah. But with UPM, we wanted to do from an end-user perspective especially, introduced new elements and the appified functionalities, whatever that means, gradually. So it's not a big change. So the end-users themselves feel, let's say, not threatened. And what it means in the UPM is that in December last year, we went live with the OneDrive for Business. Notice I'm using the right wording, OneDrive for Business, on December, which meant that their My Sites or SkyDrive Pro Sites or the OneDrive for Business sites are actually using now the gamified approach. And then the new team sites came alive also in December last year. So all the new team sites which are ordered using the self-service site collection creation are actually using this new approach. So they are provisioned using an app, and they actually have a not full trust code in them. The actual intranet, which is your picture out of it already, is going to be upgraded to the latest versions or without the full trust code during this March. Actually, right after I'm coming back from SBC. They didn't want to do anything during this week because I'm the one to blame then if everything something.
They didn't want to start without you?
Yeah. And then there's the team site migration. So this is a really big part. I'm going to have a few slides about that one. So it's not about actually making the technology to fulfill what we had and how do we build it in the new way. It's also thinking, what do we do with the existing sites? And converting the existing sites to the new technology as well.
And this is exactly the same process that we went through internally in Microsoft IT. So I actually worked on that project for about a year with Microsoft IT, and this is identical to the approach that we took internally. We had 36 terabytes of SharePoint content. You're not going to turn the lights off one day and come back on Monday and everything be migrated to the cloud. It's not going to happen. If you have a large corpus of information, you are going to have to stage this approach. For those of you that have seen this weekend or this week, we've announced some new features in SP1 about being able to put your OneDrive for Business in the cloud. That was built based on our learnings and our feedback from that MSIT project. And so as we go further in these transformations, you'll see that learning and that feedback make its way back into the product as well.
Good. And I think the key reason why we have the audience sitting in the room is to actually see how the things were really implemented. So how the transformation from the full source code was actually done and what needed to be done. And before we go there, I wanted to have one slide which is slightly explaining the difference between Office 365 dedicated and the multi-tenant and the on-prem. But this is more about quickly explaining the model that with the Office 365 dedicated, when we do the app model and provider hosted apps, the customer is actually responsible of making sure that there is a provider hosted platform. So the Office 365 dedicated, not the multi-tenant, the dedicated itself is hosted and managed by the Microsoft, but then customer is the one who's actually responsible of creating and building and hosting and operating the provider hosted environment. It might be in Windows Azure, it might be in on-prem. Slightly depends from a customer setup and the network routing. And that's essentially the key difference. But what it means is that immediately when we have that provider-hosted application, we're able to start designing a provider-hosted application platform. We're able to start designing the transformation because we can't do full trust code. We need to start running the code and operations outside of the SharePoint. And one of the key functionalities what we first implemented is the self-service site collection creation within the new way. And in the UPM case, well, this is pretty typical. We've done this now for quite a few customers.
Yep.
What we're doing is that we are overriding or we're providing a UI where people can go and request a new site collection. The out-of-the-box UI for self-service site correction is not necessarily the one what you're looking for because it's offering all the templates. And most likely, people don't want to create multiple enterprise search sites underneath your portal. So what we do is that we provide a custom UI. We provide a custom UI where people can go and select what kind of template do I want to use. And those are not actually SharePoint templates. They're abstraction templates. So it might be that there's a team site and there's a secure team site. I'm going to show that one slightly detailed in slightly later. But there's something which drives then what will be created within the SharePoint. But the whole functionality is actually hosted in the provider-hosted apps platform. Is it Windows, Azure, or on-prem? That's the same deal. In UPM's case, the provider-hosted app, which falls for self-service site collection, is actually responsible for also creating AD groups. because we didn't want to change the existing model where the authentication and authorization is based on AD groups. So when people are requesting a new site collection, the provider-hosted application is first connecting to the AD. Then it's creating those three groups, the owner, designer, and the visitor. Those are synchronized to the FIM, so we're able to delegate the authorization for the site collection owner without the usage of SharePoint groups. Somebody might be thinking, why aren't they using SharePoint groups? But that's a long discussion. That was a design decision a few years ago, and the customer wanted to do AD groups.
That is a pattern we see fairly.
And that's fairly common pattern. You can use SharePoint groups, you can use AD groups. That's a long discussion. Let's not go there. After the AD groups have been created, the provider-hosted application is then actually creating the site collection. And because it's a dedicated platform, which is essentially the same as in on-prem, we don't actually have an AD capability of creating site collections remotely right now today or a few months ago. It is coming, but for that sake, we needed to implement a small WCF endpoint, which is essentially the one which we use for creating the site collection. And then after that, what we do is that we use the typical SharePoint app technologies, like within the multi-tenant side, to drive and push the needed branding, themes, customizations, web parts, and all of that stuff into the site. So we don't use web templates, we don't use site definitions. All of that XML stuff is kind of taken away, the XML complexity. It's .NET code, which is running in provider-hosted application, which is essentially using the remote operations to create the site collection and modify that based on the branding.
And so if they were running in multi-tenant, they wouldn't need that WCF service.
Well, right? Yes. So if they would be running in multi-tenant, that custom WCF service would be not needed. So we could actually create site collections remotely as well. And we can show that tomorrow in a 403 session with Bert Janssen. So this is dedicated, as mentioned. And then you get obviously the requester actually got an email. So the whole process could take a 30 minutes, so it wasn't a synchronous process. The request was recorded. And then the requester got an email that your site is now created, and here's the AD group. You can go to FIM and manipulate who has permissions, and there you go. You're ready to move on. How does the site actually look in SharePoint 2013? I'm going to show this one in practice as well, so we're going to look into the production. But this is the high-level picture. And one of the things, like we mentioned, there was the four pillars, cost efficiency and simplicity. So the customer wanted to make the sites much more simpler. They look pretty much as out-of-the-box sites. There are certain elements. There are branding elements. It is actually a custom master page as well, which is not necessarily what we recommend, but that's completely fine as well. And there's a lot of hidden things happening on the background, which I'm going to explain and show during the demo. But it's pretty clean, pretty simple, pretty modern functionality. The SkyDrive Pro, or the OneDrive for Business branding, is a similar kind. So it's essentially using the same UPM colors, same UPM branding, same UPM end-user experience, simplified, clean, which is a one way of saving money as well.
And one thing that on the customer advisory team, we get a ton of questions around branding and how do I do my branding in a way that is going to not cost me an arm and a leg in the long run from an upgrade and customization perspective. And also another reason to think about this way is the closer you can keep your team collab and your personal sites aligned with what SharePoint is, I mean, if you want a right nav instead of a left nav and you want to hide the suite and you want to do this and do that, you're very much taking the familiarity of SharePoint away from your users, right? So just suggesting that you think about sticking closely to how SharePoint looks. Obviously, you can customize how you want, but just know you're going to pay a tax in the long run in that, and your users may or may not find it acceptable when they're searching on the internet for how to do things in SharePoint, that it looks totally different.
Yeah. And moving on the site, so the team sites and OneDrives are pretty simple. Then we do have that corporate intranet, which is a publishing site. And that's actually going to be implemented using a slightly, let's say, alternative, unconventional ways, because there's a lot of dynamic personalization information. So the intranet front page actually has a lot of things which are dependent on user profile, depending on which local location the person is, which country the person is, which is the unit, which factory, or is it a headquarters unit. And what we can actually do within the intranet, I'm unallowed to show this because there's some confidential information. But what we're going to do within the intranet front page is that we don't use actually apps at all, because you don't need to use SharePoint apps. What you can do, however, is that you implement or embed your JavaScripts to the page layout or to the master page. You have the same client-side capabilities as you have from the SharePoint apps. But now you're not limited on the iframe limitations, because the SharePoint app part is an iframe, right?
So you could have a responsive design.
You can have a responsive design, and your UI are scaling dynamically based on the content which is relevant for that particular person. So what we do is essentially that we have a lot of that web controls, what used to be a web controls or web parts, they're actually in-place divs which are driven by the JavaScript which is placed on the page layout or within the master page. We have seasons for the social. I can access Steve's profile and ask, is Steve from Finland? Oh, if Steve is from Finland? No, well, you're not. But you're from US, so therefore we show this information. And we can really easily use, for example, AngularJS, whatever technologies. Jeremy Fake is going to do a session on that actually same time as we do our session related on site provisioning tomorrow. But you can really easily build dynamic experiences without the app parts and without iframes. And the UI can be responsive. Your devices, whatever you use, they don't have then the limitations of an iframe either. So we tackle many of these challenges by just using that embedded JavaScript technology within the UPM, and now with other customers as well, which is an extremely powerful technique.
Absolutely. So we're ready to switch?
Yes. So let's actually have a look on the stuff in the real, in the production. So we're going to lock in we're going to lock in using UAG. The production. In UPM's case, we don't have a direct internet connectivity to their Office 365 dedicated, so we're going to go through their UAT for two-phase authentication, because they've been using two-phase authentication for years already. And I'm going to
He's logging in, UPM is actually using UAG to do this, but I don't know if you guys have seen recently, but we've actually launched a two-factor authentication for Office 365 as well. So if you want this level of security, you do not have to implement UAG and run on-prem. So, and as he's logging in, they're super secure. He's got to have his phone here. He's going to enter his password. They're going to send him a text, and then they're going to ask for the text. And I think Vez is going to get it right because his memory is better than mine. How many people here have actually tried to approach this problem space before of actually converting any of their solutions over?
Quite a few, actually. That's good.
Quite a few. All right. How many people are happy with that? How many people wished we had more guidance for that? Yeah, I expected to have a lot of hands. Well, we got some stuff coming for you guys at the end, so that'll be good. Do I have to hold your phone up and be
your antenna? Yeah, we can start dancing for a while. So if it doesn't actually, let's wait a few more seconds. If it doesn't do that, it's all recorded. So we have a safety link. We have a backup available. So it's always the thing. Certain things might happen. I'm going to do that one more time. So let's test it one more time if I'm not able to get in. Yeah. I have it recorded from yesterday from the hotel room.
Because you didn't have enough to do, right, Feather?
Yes.
So I'm going to talk while he's doing that. I know that if you're hosted in our multi-tenant environment, some of the stuff that we're showing here, and Vez alluded to it earlier, we're customizing master pages, we're unghosting master pages, we're changing things of that nature. I know I've personally had a lot of folks come and tell me that our innovation in the cloud has been causing them problems with their unghosted pages and the customizations that they've made. So I think you want to definitely think about if you need a custom master page in the near term, but we are working on some guidance on how best you can actually manage that as you move forward. So I see a few faces in the room of people who actually came and yelled at me personally about that problem. So I'll let you know there's good stuff coming, and if you'd like to know more, you can find me at Ask the Experts tonight.
Good. So we got in. So that's good. So we went through Finland, and now we're back on the Dublin data center, actually, in in the island. So this is the Teamsite site collection, the front page, where the end users will go and request those site collections. It's not really that good looking, and this is a version 1.0. What we're looking for pretty soon is to have a dynamic view where you're able to see all the sites where you have access, and then you're able to filter based on search metadata which sites you actually are interested in, and that's going to be filtered down. Right now, this is the 1.0 because we needed to go live. So we needed to actually go live on December. But from an end user perspective, they go to this request at team site. I'm going to be prompted quickly, and that's because I'm...
You're not on the network, right?
I'm not on the UPM network, yeah. So I'm not being trusted by these domains.
I don't know that I'd trust anybody from across the ocean logging into my stuff either. I'd probably double prompt them as well.
But there we go, and now we're able to see that SharePoint-hosted SharePoint app where we can use to actually fill up the metadata, which have the user which has the people picker. So it's actually getting that list of people which is available for selection. It has the metadata information, for example, location. I can start writing, and it's going to go through the taxonomy set. And this is metadata what we're going to then store within the site as well. So we're able to then build those dynamic lists based on the particular person. Let's go actually, on the, and then it's a matter of submitting the request. The one thing what I actually have here, what is not precisely what it looks for, is the site type. We have three options right now in day one for UPM end users: team site, community site, and secure site. The team site is pretty simple, so it's an out-of-the-box team site with the branded and all the customizations. Community sites, that's pretty self-explanatory as well. The secure site is not actually, we don't have a site definition within the product called secure site. So these are abstractions. The secure site is actually a team site, but by default, we don't provide access to every single user on that site. So the difference is only the permissions, the security. But these are abstractions. So based on the selection, we're going to create always an out-of-the-box site, but then we modify that based on the configuration, which is a pretty significant thing. So let's actually go to one of these sites. So I'm not actually accidentally showing any confidential information. So I'm going to my example VESA team site, which is underneath the upm.com/slides and VESA team. And it looks pretty much as out-of-the-box master page, but actually it is a custom master page. There's a lot of elements which are kind of hidden from an end user's perspective. We wanted to minimize the changes what we introduced. But then when we look closer, we actually see a lot of interesting stuff which is available within the UI. For example, it really doesn't matter which site you are within the UPM deployment. We always have this global cross-service navigation, which is driven by the taxonomy, one specific taxonomy term set. So it really doesn't matter where you are within your UPM network. You can always go back on the intranet home or to the tools section. Which is also personalized based on your current location. And that's driven by dynamic JavaScript. JavaScript, which is in the master page, which is accessing the taxonomy store and checking what links do I need to actually show. It's not doing that in every single time, because that would be just foolish, and we need to cache the information. So in our case, we use cookies or HTML5, a local store, just to store the information of those links. Because really, how often that set of links is going to be changed? Like 3 times in a year, max. So we're going to cache that using cookie information, or actually, in this case, local store. That's one of the things what we have on the page. The one other thing, which is not pretty obvious, is to edit the intranet profile, which looks like an out-of-the-box functionality, but no, it isn't. It's something which we have injected next to out-of-the-box functionalities, like the share, to expand the end user experience. Because in the UPM intranet, in the front page and a lot of these team sites, what you see is dependent on your user profile settings. Like which is your home location, where you are currently, which is the unit or which is the country or language you're using. So we kind of introduce a lot of these elements and functionalities in as we go. And you're able to see that the front page doesn't look precisely as a team site. So we already modified what web parts are there by default immediately when the site is created. And we use that different layout. That's not a default theme site layout. How do we do that? We use the client-side object model to create the site collection, and then we modify the sites. No full source code at all, which is pretty interesting. What else do we have on the sites, which is not precisely visible? If you go to the site settings, this was one of the things what customer wanted to ask to introduce. And you can actually see the small delay when it's updating the stuff. Customer got fed up on the fact that their end users broke their site collections all the time by going to different links within the site settings without understanding what they are, as an example, the site collection features, and activating all of them. So what we introduced is pretty simple. It's a JavaScript-based implementation where we hide unnecessarily complexity from the end user. The functionalities are still there. Obviously, if you know how to request the URL or if you're really fast when it's downloading and refreshing the page, especially now that we're in US and this is in Dublin.
So it would be a fun game for your users.
Game for the users to click the link and didn't miss it. But we try to have the simplify the experience as much as possible without breaking and without introducing any additional complexity. One of the things what people quite often need is also, for example, the information management policy. You need a content types. You need a specific content types. Classic challenges of implementing stuff is you create a new document library. How do you make sure that your own specific custom content types are available? We used to use event receivers. In this particular implementation within the UPM, we solved the requirement pretty easily. When we add a new document library, let's do this. So we go to the add an app functionality, and we add a out-of-the-box document library. We don't want to introduce, actually, secondary alternative options, because end users, they look videos from Microsoft. They go to the internet. They want to create a document library. We might be able to teach them to do something else, but it's difficult. So what we wanted to do is that we extend the out-of-the-box experience. So if I now create a SPC document library based on the out-of-the-box document library template, what's going to happen is that there's a remote event receiver which is fired against our provider-hosted app, which is actually then going back on the SharePoint and does the modifications. And so while I'm talking now, SPC document library has been modified.
So you're saying take your business logic out of SharePoint and put it in your provider.
Exactly. So we relocated that event receiver, which used to be part of the list event receiver within the site. It's now remote event receiver, which means that whenever a new library is created, we can call an external web service, which is our provider-hosted app. And then within our provider-hosted app, we connect back to the SharePoint, and we modify the SharePoint based on our requirements. So right now, if I actually upload a document to this library, we're able to see the impact immediately. So let's take here my boarding pass and upload that to the site.
Working on it.
There we go, and clicking OK. So we're able to see that we're asking that custom metadata for that particular document, which is the title, security classification, unit, location, keywords. That's not the out-of-the-box experience. But we did the associations automatically, so that the end user doesn't have to go and activate anything. It's created automatically based on the provisioning.
And the developer didn't have to write CAM.
And
CAML, sorry.
The developer didn't have to write any CAML, any feature framework or anything like that. It's the whole system can be enabled using the appified technologies as well. One of the things what we talked about yesterday with Steve when we were planning what we're going to actually show is the fact that isn't that quite a lot of stitching different technologies and approaches together when you're stitching a lot of apps and all of that. From an end-user perspective, we enable all the business requirements, what needs to be done. But yes, this is quite a lot of stitching. But when you think of it, isn't full trust code quite often quite a lot of stitching?
Yeah.
It's ONET XML, it's feature XML, it's element XML, then it's module elements, you need to put them in the right format. Yes, we do have an awesome tooling in Visual Studio nowadays, and those guys who've been involved since 2007 know that we didn't have at the time. You were forced to do DDF files.
So I think the point that we want to make here is, yes, it feels like you're doing a lot of stitching, but that's just because we all learned how to stitch those quilts with the tools that we had from 2007 until 2010. We're just familiar with those stitches, right? Yes, you're going to learn new approaches. You're going to do things different ways. But by abstracting these things away from the platform, you are defending yourself against us at Microsoft when we deploy new updates, and all of a sudden that event receiver that you had goes wonky or that full trust code was dependent on something and we changed it, you won't be diving in and troubleshooting those things. And then, we're defending ourselves from you. So when you try to do things abusive to our farms or inject things in there that are highly dangerous or risky, you're not going to call and tell us SharePoint is broken and throw us out the door.
And the one thing what I want to tell you so, is the branded or customized My Insights. And as mentioned, this is not highly customized, but it is a custom master page. The customer wanted to go really small on the end user changes. So if we would have to fall back on Artworks master page, it wouldn't be significant. You could introduce a highly customized master page for the OneDrive for business sites as well. I can't get it. But in this case, it's pretty small customizations. But once again, when you are in the My Insights, we have that intranet home functionality, the tools functionality on the top left corner. The end users will always find their back on the intranet. I'm unallowed to actually click that one now, right now, so as we talk. But it's always there. They don't get lost. The one thing what we also did is that we are using the client-side object model in a provider-hosted application, making sure that my personal SkyTrack Pro site is branded as well. And the fellow who's doing that is actually pretty well visible in the UI. It's this one in here, which doesn't actually do anything else than write or renders a white marker. But what it does on the background, it uses server-side code in a provider-hosted platform to connect to my user profile, to connect to my site, SkyTrack Pro site, and to apply the branding, what needs to be applied. So we are automatically, now that the end users always come through to this intranet using this particular page, we're making sure that their SkyTrive Pro, OneDrive for business branding, is applied correctly. And we're using the same fellow for any updates. So we already released actually three different versions of the personal MySite branding. We only have to modify this particular app part, which is actually hanging. It's going to be hanging in the front page of the intranet. Right now, it's hanging on the public side of the SkyTrack Pro. And that's taken care of, applying off the branding, any updates, whatever customizations needs to be done on the SkyTrack Pro site. So we're able to do that also without any full trust code.
Who here's going to miss stapling features on the personal sites and doing all of that and updating them all? Yeah.
And coming back on that one, we do have a technical demo tomorrow waiting on that 403 session when I'm going to show the real code, how it's actually done, how do we handle the SkyTrive Pro branding. But now when I go to the OneDrive for business branding,
yes.
When I go to the OneDrive for business, my personal OneDrive for business, we're able to see once again, we have that custom master page available. The links are there. We have a custom branding. We do have that edit intranet profile available there as well. So it's really applying all needed customizations as needed within the site. Good. That's quickly about that one. Let's go back on the slides, okay. And let's raise the final extremely important topic, which we need to consider related on the transformation to the appified world. The one thing is how do we enable functionalities? How do we actually make that web part functionality, web control functionality, or how do we apply branding to the OneDrive for business sites? We can enable that. You can go to, we have just released a massive amount of examples to actually enable this all for you. I'm gonna show all of that information, the links and URLs slightly later. But that's easily doable. Technology is actually easy. It's just a matter of somebody writing a blog post or guidance, this is how you do it, and then other people to follow up on that. But what we need to, however, remember is actually, what do we do with the existing sites? So what about those existing sites and existing customizations, like the 2000 site collections, theme site collections, what the customer now has, using the 2010 full trust code? And that is a massive challenge, because that requires then completely alternative means, and it's highly dependent on what exact details you have on the site, which is a awesome consulting opportunity, but for the customers, it's not necessarily a awesome deal. So let's actually deep dive on that one slightly from a customization perspective. But key point of this migration part is that quite often people concentrate, sorry, I'm a developer, I don't need to know about that. But the reality is that your customizations won't be deployed to the production unless we actually take care of this one as well.
And the reality of the traditional development patterns that we've all known, grown, and loved in SharePoint very much marries the application functionality and the business logic from the data, with the data constructs that live within SharePoint. So doing things like laying feature files down on disks and laying content types and site columns down on disks and files, if you just try to, even if you remove or replace some of the application functionality, you pull those out, and what happens?
So let's have a few slides on that one, and let's cover through those typical scenarios which we need to think through, and how do we implement, for example, timer jobs using the alternative means. But essentially, what's the challenge? So what are we talking about? The reality is that the challenge is the existing sites. The existing sites depend on the full source code. So they do have a references to the full source code, which is in the file system. They might have a reference to the master page, which is in a 15 hive. They might have a reference to content type elements within a 15 hive. So let's talk about that one slightly. The number one challenge and number one transformation step, if you are using publishing sites or if you're using theme sites with the custom master pages, is that you need to get rid of the old ones and you need to replace them with the new customized, the new versions without the full source code. How do we do that? Well, we can easily push the module elements and master pages across the site collections and sites. Using the client-side object model. That's the remote provisioning 101. Client-side object model gives us the capability to send a file across the wire to the cloud and put a properties properly. Then it's just a matter of scanning through the existing files and scanning through the existing pages and sites and modify that it doesn't use the old master page, it uses the new master page. Pretty simple. If you do have a 5,000 sites, well, it's going to take a slightly longer than 5 sites. If you do have a 50,000 site collections, yes, it's going to take slightly longer because you're going to have to go them one by one. But that's how it's done. There's really no alternative way of doing that. Within the UPM, what we did is that we're actually using this kind of a centralized component, which is on that C# element within the UI. And we call that centralized component from our provider hosted app for the operations, and then for these mass updates, we're doing the same thing, but we're using PowerShell. So from the PowerShell, we're controlling that centralized remote operation component, which has all of these awesome capabilities, to actually then modify the master pages within the existing sites. Pretty simple stuff, and again, downloadable already right now today for you from our CodePlex project, which we're going to share the URL today. What about replacement of web parts and controls? That's a slightly different thing. So there's multiple approaches on if you have existing web parts and controls. Like we've covered through, there's no one-for-one. You can't say, well, I have a web part, it's going to be an app part. That would be foolish. Because quite often what you want to do is that you implement that same element which used to be a web control or web part as a embedded JavaScript on the page layout, as an example. Or it might be in the master page level. So we need to think about what is the web part actually doing and how we can actually change that. Technically, we are able to do a site loading, which essentially means that we're able to inject our apps directly to the sites to enable app parts within the site as well. So that's one way of then scanning through the existing sites and checking, oh, there's a web part called Steve. Let's replace that web part called Steve to an app part called Vesa. It's just a matter of building that logic which scans through the sites and fixing them as we go.
And I think one thing to reinforce here is back to a point Veza made very early on in the conversation. This shouldn't be a one-to-one mapping. You should definitely look at what it is that you're replacing. Quite often we see developers build web parts that maybe were needed in 2007. They were carried forward into 2010. And then in 2013, maybe we have application functionality that makes that web part no longer needed. Take this as an opportunity to replace that now so that you're not continuing to accrue that sustained engineering effort due to those customizations. Yes.
Quite often in 2007 or 2010, we implemented custom web parts which were doing aggregation cross-site collections or something like that. Yep. And now in 2013, we have an added awesome client-side the search functionality, shows web parts, which we can use to actually fulfill the same requirement. So we can get rid of the existing customization completely. But that's what it is. We need to analyze them one by one. And to be honest, the devil is in the details.
That's right.
It's not a how many web parts, oh, this is going to take X amount of time. It's about show me what do you have, and let's analyze that. Then the one slide which has caused quite a lot of discussions, at least within my blog post when I wrote this one down, certain people in the community went really ballistic. What I'm saying in the blog post is essentially don't use feature framework elements for deploying content types or site columns. And I know MSDN is saying for you right now today that please do that. But we haven't been able to yet update the MSDN. It's going to be updated. The technical writers are working on it. But the challenge is that if we use feature framework elements and element XMLs for deploying content types and site columns, we will create a dependency on the files which are in the file system to those content types which are in the content database. And even though we use tricks which certain persons included in my blog post comments as well, that dependency doesn't completely get rid of. So that means that you have content within your content databases which have a dependency on files within a file system, which means that you can't get rid of that FTC. If you retract the stuff from file system, it might seem that you're fine for 2 weeks, and then it's going to bite you. Or then you go to a level when you update, everything looks really good, and then we release a new cumulative patch. Mm-hmm. Your IT pro is going to go and install the new cumulative patch on your farm, and at that point, everything went ballistic. And you lose the data.
Yeah. Or you figure out that you no longer need those full trust code solutions, and you retract them because they're no longer needed, and then everything blows up.
Yes.
Because you didn't find where that dependency was. And one of the big pieces of feedback that we got, and I'm on the engineering team, Veza's in services, we work pretty close together, we've got a team of folks. One of the big pieces of feedback we got about this one specifically was, we can't set the ID of that content type, so then how do I know dependably later that I need to manipulate it again? How am I going to retrieve that one? We've heard, we've listened, and you'll be hearing something soon on a solution for that. So,
but the key point of this slide is definitely the one, if you don't do full trust code, if you have a new project starting right now today, for the full trust code, and it seems to be that it's full trust code for upcoming 2 years. That's completely fine.
Yep.
You're good. It's not old school. That's reality. We support that in the future as well. But what you might want to consider is that you use actually feature framework, feature receiver, to create your content type and site columns using code. You get that XML away. You minimize the XML, because in that case, you actually create the content type and site columns directly to the content database. So if we retract that full trust code away from the farm, the stuff is in the content database. Everything will still work. Mm-hmm. So you lose that dependency, and that's gonna be much, much easier than to migrate to the new world whenever, if there's a transition to the cloud, as an example. And I know that it's a controversial statement. I completely understand that. But this is what we're now struggling with many of our customers, because we don't have a native out-of-the-box way of getting rid of this dependency. BG is working on that,
yeah.
as Steve mentioned. So there will be a solution at some stage for that one as well. Yeah. But a good learning. The one thing about we wanted to also mention, Kirk is in the front row of the audience. Good to have you here in the class as well. Kirk released a good example of a timer. How do we do timer jobs in the CAM or appified world last week, or was it on weekend actually? But how do we do timer jobs? Well, you can't do timer jobs natively within the new world, because the classic timer jobs require full trust code. What we do is that we schedule the stuff executing somewhere, schedule the stuff to be running somewhere else. It's running in the provider hosted app. It's running in the Windows Azure, like the web jobs, like in Kirk's example. And then it's using the client-side object model to operate against the SharePoint. Then at this stage, you should be asking, What if it's functionality which is not exposed?
What if it's functionality that's not exposed? What do I do then?
Well, the reality is that then we need to fall back on the old technologies, which is the web services, which is one option, or then we just need to accept the fact that maybe it's not meant to be modified.
Just because you can doesn't mean you should.
There we go.
Yeah.
SharePoint is a terrifying tool when I think of it. We can modify that in a multiple different way, and we've been teaching people how to do that. But we need to always think about, is it worthwhile? So it really challenging those requirements as well. That's a good thing. Or redesigning the pattern.
One comment, how many people in the audience have ever gone into a customer you've never been in before, and you start tearing the hood apart, and then you get that dirty, nasty feeling about whatever it was that guy did on those farms. I see a lot of heads shaking. I mean, one man's FTW is another man's WTF, right? Let's try to keep that out of the SharePoint farms, all right?
I'm not a native English-speaking person, so I need to think about that.
We'll move on.
Tell me afterward.
No, I will. Never.
The one thing what I wanted to also raise is that the case of a bad headache, so what will be a problematic things? If you have custom field types, field controls, they are fine. Field controls are okay. Custom field types, you're screwed. Not a native English-speaking person. I'm allowed to use dirty words. And the second thing, custom site definitions. We don't have a real solution for it. Custom field types, custom site definitions. And I know we did this. I'm teaching within my blog post and articles how to do that in 2007 or 2008. So I've destroyed many of the deployments as well. But we need to be aware of these things. So if you have a deployment where we have custom field types, custom site definitions, or if you are moving from a site which had a publishing feature enabled and you want to get rid of them, there's no alternative way than do a full migration. And that's where the third-party components will help, but you need to do it's a completely different story. It's a big thing. So you need to be aware of that. In the case of UPM, as mentioned, I'm the one to blame. Every single team site we need to do a full migration. We need to get rid of that publishing feature. And it's going to actually cost, from a timing perspective, it's roughly a half a year. So it's going to be pretty costly. The decision wasn't good, but that happens. A really good example, we all make mistakes. How do we succeed in the migration? This is pretty simple, actually. How do we make sure that the migrations are successful? How do we actually do this migration? You have a 100% success from the FTC to CAM code migrations when you actually do it manually.
100%. Works every time.
Because it means that you take a site, and then you track and drop the files to another site, and then you set the properties, and then you go to another file, and then track and drop the files. And seriously, we've done calculations with some of the customers, and it might be that in some certain cases, it might be actually a cheaper option than actually doing the automated way. Now, we do have third-party players, and we do have awesome partners in the migration side as well. But you need to do that business value calculation. Because when we start migrating between the FTC to the CAM, or we need to do this getting rid of the custom site definition, it is a difficult thing. It's the massage part within the process. And it depends.
And it's not a good massage.
It's not a good massage.
Yeah.
But essentially what it means is that we need to get the data away from the SharePoint, export that. For example, we export that. If you use community tooling written by Kimma Force mainly, I've done some of that as well, but Kimma is the key player, that is exporting the data to a non-native XML format. Then we massage the data, which essentially means that we get rid of all these full source code dependencies, we change the site definition references and all of that. And then we import the data back in using these community tools.
And this massage means cracking open prime packages, diving into XML, manipulating it, changing things, hoping you get it right. That CodePlex tool there is actually a great tool that can do some of those things, but we have third-party vendors who make those things a lot easier and a lot more predictable. So just understand if you can't speak camel and can't crack open prime packages and read them, then you may want to look at a tool.
Most likely you want to go with a third-party tool because they have a support, they have a documentation, they have specialists to do so. Community tooling is not always the most cheapest one.
They have people you can call when your CEO can't get to his site.
But that's the key point. That's actually the main message and the main story with the UPM case. What I wanted to do is still a few slides related on recapping on the business value for customers. So what I wanted to really, emphasize, the customer wasn't sure if they want to go Office 365, if they want to go in on-prem, if they want to go third party. But what they wanted to do is that they want to have all of their customization built in a way that they can make that decision tomorrow and again on a week from that. Because they don't know when there will be a new CIO within that company who is cloud friendly and who says, we're going to go to the cloud. Even though 2 weeks ago, somebody said that custom site definitions are cool. things change. So their IT wanted to have that flexibility of choosing which platform do they want to use. And therefore, they're using this app world to replace the FTC. Do you need to do that? Not necessarily. There's always a, you need to think about and evaluate options. This was a decision within the UPM.
And I will say, to add on to that, as more and more customers are seeing us getting better, us being Microsoft, getting better at innovating in the cloud and adding new features without having to wait 3 years and seeing that the value is there, I know that we're going to continue to accelerate that. Being cloud ready becomes an ever more important aspect of your planning moving forward, because these big projects, if you've got a 36 terabyte farm, you're going to be on this journey for a while. This is not something that's going to happen overnight. So the last thing you want is the new CIO coming in 2 years from now and telling you we're going to the cloud tomorrow, because that's going to be an epic journey with a whole lot of bodies and a whole lot of money. So.
And the second bullet point what we have, I'm kind of telling that, you saw now what it actually means, the agility for business. Quite often in UPM's case, it means that what if there's a organization which want to have a modification on their master page? If we would have used the old methods, it probably would have been master page within the 15 hive. And to update or do changes on that, it would have been a service break. In the new way, the master pages are within the site collection. They are actually in a content database. So now we can go and modify one site, two sites, or 50,000 sites without any downtime, without actually impacting or scheduling any service breaks for the service. It's just us doing a remote calls to the site and pushing the master pages or modifications or widgets to the sites.
Yep.
The cost efficiency, well, it comes down pretty much on exactly on that same thing. The old model was extremely, especially in UPM's case, their process was pretty strict, which was academically correct. It was definitely academically correct, but it took a lot of time, and time is money. So now we can actually, right now, today, if we find a bug within the production, we can go and update that without impacting, again, no downtime. We're just going to do an update on the production because there's no full test code. Everything is running on the database. Everything is coming from the database. So therefore, we can do modifications on fly if we want. We probably don't want to do that, but still.
And it also reduces your tax and the cost that you pay testing your custom solutions when you apply things like Service Pack 1.
Yes.
Because your customizations are outside the farm. They're not inside the farm. Less risk that we're going to break you. We're very tightly coupled together when we're marching together inside that same host process, folks. So moving apart a little bit lets us both go at our own speeds.
So let's move on the key takeaways. Just to mention a few things, the summarized things. You should not compare FTC to CAM. Do not make the false assumption that you can go and if there's X amount of web pods, that's going to be X amount of fat pods. That's not the reality. Or you can do so, but that's not necessarily the right way of doing that. What we want to do is really analyze what is there and how is it actually used to bring the new value for the end users.
And one thing from my personal experience that I'll share here, and this really isn't even FTC to CAM. This was before we had the new cloud app model. I go into a customer, and they tell me how complex their environment is, and they tell me they have 55 master pages and 47 page layouts, and they have 186 distinct web parts, and it's going to cost all this money, and this is a big, huge project. And I go in there, well, first big indicator was they had more master pages than page layouts, so that was very confusing, right? and then 186 different web parts. And what I really found when I cracked the hood open, when we got done with that project to refactor that, we had one master page, we had 17 page layouts. I replaced 127 of those web parts with a content query web part. So they had a bunch of .NET devs that they threw at this SharePoint server who developed like .NET devs. And hey, we're moving to a world where they could do that now. They can go write an MVC app over there in a provider host and do that. But back in the day, before people knew how to develop on SharePoint, there's a lot of that out there. So definitely look at it from that perspective.
And remember to consider content. It's not about technology, just. You need to think about, do we need to convert the existing stuff and migrate them to the new technology as well? The one chosen really good pattern is just to forget about them. essentially, live with the full source code until nobody's using those site collections anymore.
That is another option.
With the new site collection. That's a design decision. That's a completely valid architectural design decision as well. and not a bad idea, because then you minimize the cost related on how do we migrate the existing stuff.
That's right. And we see that a lot in businesses where business units own their own budgets and they don't want to move. They want to keep their stuff where it's at. Great, keep your stuff where it's at. Don't pay for the money to do that. You guys can stay back there. And then everybody, all the other business units will move over and, you know, go to this other nice, friendly environment that gets innovation a lot quicker. Eventually, those guys will figure out their dinosaurs and they'll want to pony up the money.
And the final thing is that there's a lot of proven patterns, and we're going to actually make a lot of new content in the MSDN available more frequently, more often, all the time. What we just did this weekend is that we went live with an AMS app model samples. So if you go to the HTTP office AMS codeplex.com, you are actually getting access to all of these things, what we have done for all of these customers. So many of the codes and patterns and functionalities are shown using Contoso namespaces, and you are able to download and start using them on day one. It's there for you to start play with, to get familiar on cases, and they actually work just by pressing the F5. We've tested them pretty heavily. So that's definitely a source for you to remember when you start looking into this area, or when you start looking at SharePoint app development in general. Good examples, there's people like Kirk has been involved, Richard de la Seca, I've done a lot of stuff, Bert Janssen, a lot of internal people, Steve been driving, Sonia has been involved, Rob Hobart has been involved, and so on.
And I would like to take this as an opportunity to just let you guys know, we have a highly motivated group of folks. We know that this is a journey. We haven't answered all the questions. And so this is a manifestation of our work internally over the last year and a half to 2 years. Working with MSIT, going through this with some of these customers who are early adopters, and making sure that we capture those patterns and practices. And so we look forward to sharing that. We have versions of this internally. You know, we'll release it as updates to this package. And then, if you're scared to tear apart code, because I'll just be blunt. There's a this is very much code centric, and there's some one-page documentation, two-page documentation on each one of the samples. So if you're a developer, you're probably okay with it. But if you want the comfort that you're going to get full MSDN documentation, we have MSDN solution packs that are also being published, which is full content publishers coming in and writing up all of the documentation. So if tearing apart code scares you and you want to wait, we still have an answer for you. And there's a link to the solution pack downloads on the app model samples site. So.
Good. Yeah. And that's all we're going to actually do today. So thanks for your time, and feel free to come up with the questions after the session from a timing perspective.
Thanks.